Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
We've already been teased by signs of an approaching spring. It's March, and March is just what we're going to do, right into this week's edition of Spectrum West. This week, UW Eau Claire is the best college in Wisconsin for LGBTQ students, according to bestcolleges.com, and most importantly, to the students themselves. The guy who runs the Gender and Sexuality Resource Center on campus is Chris Jorgensen. He is with us today. Kathy Reitz directs a whole bunch of singers in three different configurations, the Chippewa Valley Community Chorus, the Chippewa Valley Youth Chorus, and the Stand in the Light Choir. They will join forces on a few numbers during special community chorus concerts next weekend. Kathy is here to fill us in. Peter Olson is a lecturer in the UW Stout College of Arts, Communication, Humanities, and Social Services. His disciplines are English and philosophy. He's here to talk about the annual Reading Across Campus project, which combines a classic book, its accompanying movie, discussion of social significance, and this year a special guest visits the Menominee campus. And Jim Oliver's here with John Kunick, director of the FIP Center, production of Once Upon a Mattress opening in a week. All that. But first, we talked in depth about a few weeks ago because we wanted you guys to have ample notice to prepare your potential participation. Well, the time is nigh. Saturday's the day, and one of the organizers, Dan Ott, is back with a last-minute briefing.
Saturday from 11 to 4 at the Chippewa Valley Museum in Eau Claire's Carson Park, we will be hosting the Sounds of Eau Claire History Harvest. And at this event, we are inviting people from the community to share their memories and their artifacts and their objects related to music history in not just Eau Claire, but the surrounding region, you know, like the entire Chippewa Valley. And we're hoping that in doing so, we will create a digital archive, which we will be able to preserve and share with the community about local music history, because we really do not have a lot of sources about the depth and breadth of Eau Claire's musical past. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the key goal, is having people bring in stuff and share it with us and share it with their community. Everything that's going to be brought in is going to go home with contributors. You're not going to lose your precious heirlooms. You're donating them and sharing them with us digitally. So beyond just that digitization process, we are also going to have live music throughout the museum. Buskers are going to be playing in museum exhibit spaces, which is fun. There'll be a couple musicians in the auditorium, and we'll also have three presentations on the musical culture and history of the region.
I'd like people to know that they shouldn't minimize anything that they have. What they may think is nothing may turn out to be just a wonderful find for people like you. I envision this kind of as a musical antiques roadshow.
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the things about history is we tend to sort of think that only certain things count as history, and that it's sort of the canon, you know, these major moments. It's just indie rock or it's just Eau Claire jazz. And we really want to get beyond that to sort of bring in people who have stories that aren't necessarily related to those mainstream, well-treaded narratives, so that we can preserve a broader past. And so if people are concerned that they have something that maybe doesn't fit in, they should bring it, because it's important to them, and if it's important to them, it means something about our community. And so that's an important idea, I think, for everyone to sort of understand. If you've got stories that don't necessarily fit in with that mainstream narrative, that doesn't mean that those stories shouldn't be told and those stories shouldn't be part of our history. And so when I think about this project, it extends beyond the well-known to include things like, how do people interact with music in their living rooms? What sort of traditions do they have with their families or their community groups or in their sanctuaries, right? So that we can present and preserve a full understanding, a full sort of picture of the musical moment and its roots.
When you were up in the attic and you found that concertina, we'd kind of like to know the history of that concertina.
Oh, yeah. No, if people have, I think this is one of the cool things that's going to happen. people are going to bring out their artifacts, their heirloom instruments, and these sort of things that have been passed down through their family. And I think those would be fantastic things to share. And I think that people are also going to bring in stuff that's a little bit more contemporary and say, well, I would like to preserve something about the more recent folk movement or something about more recent music festivals or something like that. And all that stuff is welcome, particularly when we're just thinking about grasping the full diversity of ways in which people access music, right? Because music is really deeply cultural in a whole variety of ways, not quite as much as language, but it is one of those ways in which people define who they are and define their community groups. Yep. And so we want to welcome all of that into the History Harvest event.
Your chance to be part of history, and that's literal.
Absolutely. So. You know, put your story on the record, right? Share it with us, and then it'll be preserved, and then people will be able to find out about it in the future, or find out about it even in the present. And that's another thing that's really important to me, is that people can sort of see the way in which music works in this community in a broader way than how they traditionally understand it from just their own perspective. Again, Saturday from 11 to 4 at the Chippewa Valley Museum in Eau Claire's Carson Park. It is free to the public. If you have a huge collection of objects, you've got tons of stuff, we're probably not going to be able to process all of it, but we would like you to bring in some stuff. We'll be set up to collect people's information so that we can set up individual appointments afterwards, or we also have an overflow event scheduled at the university on April 14th.
Good. I'm glad you brought that up. If they don't come Saturday, it's not too late.
No, absolutely not. They can come back again. Yeah, if you miss out on Saturday because you got something going on, there'll be other opportunities.
Okay, Dan, thanks for the reminder.
Thank you so much, Al. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Saturday is going to be interesting. Coming up, reading across campus and the campus's UW Stout, a special designation for UW Eau Claire, Jim Oliver and guest waiting in the wings on Spectrum West. Now, it was Stephen Sondheim who said, "If I cannot fly, let me sing," suggesting that singing provides similar sky-high exhilaration and soaring perspective on most things, from the effortless to the challenging. Kathy Wrights is helping people realize the power of singing. It helps define community, offers young people a technology sabbatical, and infuses more memory into memory care. The Chippewa Valley Community Chorus, Chippewa Valley Youth Chorus, and Stand in the Light Memory Choir. Kathy stopped in for a conversation about some opportunities coming to hear all that singing. What is the difference between a choir and a chorus?
Nothing.
Here's what I found, though.
Oh.
A chorus is a larger group of singers, while a choir is a smaller body.
Oh, really? I did not know that. Yeah, the reason the Chippewa Valley Community Chorus is called a chorus was it probably was a larger body of singers when it started. I'm going to guess that.
So let's define each ensemble that you stand in front of. The community chorus, what is that?
The community chorus is made up of adults, 18 to literally 80, from the Chippewa Valley area, so Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire. We have a couple of people driving in from Bloomer. And we meet from January to March, and okay. It's really just for the joy of singing choral music. Okay. And we are based out of the Heidi Center.
Stand in the Light. Let's define that again for people who did not hear our last conversation.
Stand in the Light Memory Choir is for people with early diagnosis dementia and a care partner. So every person who comes who has dementia has a partner. Sometimes it's their caregiver, okay. And sometimes we just have singing partners. But everyone is paired up with someone.
And the youth choir. Is it a choir or a chorus?
Well, it's really a choir because it's smaller. But we do call it a chorus.
We're going to nitpick about this forever now, aren't we?
I hear that all the time. It's all right.
Yeah.
So the youth choir is open to anyone, again, in the Chippewa Valley area, grades 2 through 7. We meet once a week, and it's really just to give kids another chance to sing in a non-threatening environment.
So we've talked previously about the benefits of singing and music in one's life. Let's focus on the youth choir or chorus. You know, it's one thing to sing and get to know each other at rehearsals as far as, and these are young kids.
Yep.
But it's quite another to perform in front of an audience. So
right.
I'm guessing that young kids garner a lot of good stuff from not only participating, but then standing in front of
right. people. I think it really does build a confidence of, I'm up here, but they're not alone. And I'm always just amazed at how quickly they take to that. I'm up here. Oh, look at people are watching me. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And they have a great time. So it teaches that kind of confidence, but it also teaches I need to support the people on either side of me because we're all up here together.
So that's kids. How do people in Stand in the Light handle performing? Is performing a completely different animal for them than just getting together?
I think it's a little different. But on the other hand, it is a chance for people with early diagnosis who maybe have opened that door to like, oh, no, now what's the rest of my life going to be? It gives them a chance to accomplish something, to do something that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think that's probably the most important thing.
That makes sense.
It gives them a chance to, again, accomplish something, be a part of something.
The last time you were here, I happened upon the observation that you, being a choir director, get to face these people, and speaking of face, get to see what's on their faces.
Right.
And so I would guess that let's start with the kids. Kids love to sing.
Kids love to sing, and they really, most of them, love to perform, and you just have to give them that chance. So
being a ham is something that's...
It's awesome.
It's inbred from the beginning. Yeah.
And that's the trickiest part with kids is you have to be like, you can be a ham, you can have lots of fun, but not that much fun. They have to learn where the boundaries are. But to see kind of that unbridled joy, it's awesome.
So people in Stand in the Light now, facial expressions. Do you, as the conductor, see... What's the word I'm looking for? Do you see revelation? Do you see moments of realization that you didn't see when they were just maybe conversing with you?
Yes. I mean, we talk about it and you can read about it, but the truth is every week I see certain people kind of shuffle in, not really remember who I am, not really know why are we in this church, and we start singing and those people are there.
Wow.
That music triggers the, I'm a part of this. I know this. I can do this. Mm-hmm. I truly see that revelation, that joy, that, oh my gosh, I have something good. And, henceforth our name, Stand in the Light. We're still giving off that light. And what I find interesting is then not only is the song recalled, but the memories associated with that song. So exciting thing. Not only do they enjoy singing, but then we get to hear these stories. You know, I remember first time I heard this song. This song reminds me of, so it brings back even more memories.
All of us often just kind of schlep through life doing many of the same things, and then here goes the sound effect. Pow! I hit my hand with my fist. We're hit with something new. So the experience with your sister and your subsequent involvement with the Stand Choir changed Kathy Wright's. For one thing, it must have added a whole lot to your appreciation for the strength of music.
It really did. I knew that. Yeah. My intellectual self knew that. I wrote papers on it. I gave speeches on it. I taught for 30 plus years. But to see it happen and to be a part of that, it really is a moving experience.
Kathy Wright's with us. The Chippewa Valley Community Chorus has some concerts coming up. Saturday, March 10th, 7 p.m. Sunday, March 11th, 2 p.m. Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The reason that we were speaking of the youth choir and the Stand in the Light choir or chorus. Now I'm paranoid about what to call them. I should just call them all choruses or all choirs.
You can do whatever you want.
I have to, because if I differentiate, it's going to drive me crazy. Those choirs, which I chose because it's easier to say than choruses.
It is, yes.
Are special guests of the Chippewa Valley Community Chorus in those two concerts. I saw a sample song list for dementia patients, and they were songs that my parents would know. And I said to myself, make a note, Al, because that stuff's going to have to change soon, because my generation has a whole different playlist.
Right. Right, and it actually is changing already.
Is it?
So,
okay.
So for instance, like we do some songs, maybe from your parents' generation,
yes.
But in this concert, like we're doing "Blown in the Wind,"
oh, there you go.
And "If I Had a Hammer," and songs from "Sound of Music." Okay. It is changing. Yeah, it's not Bicycle Built for Two anymore.
So, what is on the repertoire for the concerts on the 10th and 11th?
Probably the most exciting part is that we are combining all three choirs on a couple of songs.
Oh, wow.
One of them will be "Blown in the Wind," And then we're doing another one, an original song by Jerry Way up from Chippewa Falls,
sure,
called What a Beautiful Day, and that's going to be fun. And the youth choir is singing with the community choir in a John Rutter piece called Look at the World. But mostly what we've done is we've taken our theme, What a Wonderful World, and just really tried to bring songs out that maybe will remind you of what a wonderful world it is, doing that by conjuring up a memory. And some of the songs, we really just kind of tell you, hey, you know, get out of your funk. This is time to look around and step up.
I love the fact that you're introducing young kids to the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
You have to explain Blowing in the Wind to them because it does have some social significance to it.
Yes, it does. When you give those words to a young kid, you don't have to tell them it's from the 60s.
Yeah.
They think it's from now.
I hope they're thinking about what they're singing, because a lot of times you don't. I mean, you know the words, you memorize them, but you don't even have to memorize with this group, do you?
No, not with my community course. My kids always memorize.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. I find that that's better for them, just being able to get past that piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, their brains are so awesome. They memorize very fast.
Do they?
Mm-hmm.
So someone out there is listening, and they say, wow, Kathy is directing three different choirs or choruses. How do I or someone close to me get involved?
Well, they can always contact me directly. Look me up on Facebook and send me a message.
Okay.
You can also look up each choir individually.
Is it a big group?
We have about 65 members. Mm-hmm.
There's a cap?
Not yet.
Not yet? Bigger the better.
Sure.
Why not?
Singing it with a group of people is an amazing thing. It really creates a community. And I know some people shy away from that word. You know, no, I want to stand alone. I don't need other people. But really, as humans, we need to have some community time.
Sure.
This is a great way to do that.
And thus the name, Community Chorus.
Right.
Okay, so the others?
Yeah, the Chippewa Valley Youth Chorus, you can contact the Eau Claire Music School, Nick Poss.
Oh, yeah.
And because that's where we're based out of, and you can go to their website and find all kinds of things. And then the Sand and the Light Memory Choir, again, you can go online and just type that in. You'll find us.
Kathy Wright's always a pleasure. Thanks. And we look forward to your concerts on Saturday and Sunday, the 10th and 11th.
Thanks.
Saturday, March 10th, 7 p.m., Sunday, March 11th, 2 p.m., Heidi Center for the Arts, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, of course. The voices of the Chippewa Valley Community Chorus, Chippewa Valley Youth Chorus, Stand in the Light Memory Choir. If I cannot fly, let me sing. And maybe, at times, it'll feel like flying. Spectrum West on WPR, and support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. The Landscape Lullabies Concert features The Moldau by Smetana and Dvorak's Symphony No. 7, Saturday at the State Theater. Details at cvsymphony.org. Support also comes from Chanhassen Dinner Theaters, performing Disney's new Broadway musical, Newsies, presented by Star Tribune. A high-energy song and dance celebration. More information available at chanhassendt.com. Jim Oliver's here, as he is most every week, thanks to our lucky stars. And today, his spotlight swings to Hudson, Wisconsin. Mr. Oliver, the stage is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. Once Upon a Mattress, a musical comedy based on the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, will open Friday, March 9th, and continue Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays through March 31st at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Joining us by telephone is the director, John Kunick. Well, Once Upon a Mattress opened in 1959, starring Carol Burnett. Other names associated with the early productions include Imogene Coca and silent film star Buster Keaton. It has since also been adapted for television a number of times. What makes Once Upon a Mattress such a popular show?
Oh, okay. I was very excited when I found I had the opportunity to direct this production over at Phipps, mostly because my very first season of summer stock as an undergraduate student was in Michigan at a place called the Musical Tent. And in that one summer, we did 9 full-scale musicals in 10 weeks.
Wow.
Full choreography, full chorus, full orchestra. And Once Upon a Mattress was one of those shows. There were 2 shows that summer that made me laugh myself silly. Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum and Once Upon a Mattress. It's a fun story. Everybody knows the story. It's, you know, it's a variation on The Princess and the Pea. And we're taking a bit of a fractured fairy tales approach and adding some wacky humor to the show. We're doing this show with probably fewer people than most people use in a production. Most people run around 25, 26, 27 cast members. We're doing it with 19.
Mm.
So a lot of them are doing double time, and they're doing a great job. So people are going to get Once Upon a Mattress. They're going to get that show, but it's just going to be some little fringe things that are going to be, I think, pretty enjoyable for people.
Now, you made the comment about it's a fractured fairy tale, and I, back in my younger days, used to wake up on Saturday morning and watch Rocky and Bullwinkle, and yeah. They're fractured fairy tales. What do we mean by a fractured fairy tale?
Well, it's the tone. You shift the tone a little. For example, without giving too much away, a couple of ladies are being chased during the play, and when they lift their skirts a little bit, they're wearing tennis shoes.
Hmm.
Little things like that. Little anachronistic bits of humor, because it's supposed to be medieval times.
And you wouldn't find tennis shoes in medieval times, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're twisting it up a little. And people who enjoy Carol Burnett comedy sketches are going to enjoy this show. People who enjoyed the old Rowan and Martin laugh-in are going to enjoy this show. We've kind of mixed it up. Mm-hmm. We've taken it and we've made it a glorified comedy sketch with a little bit of a fractured fairy tale attitude.
Uh-huh.
As I said, you know, we've got a group of real good people, and they're working real hard, and we've got some really good, fun musical numbers. It's interesting that none of the songs in the show ever became what you would consider popular, like some shows have. But within the show, some of them are very hysterical. Our cast does a great job with them.
Well, we're talking to John Koenig, who is director of the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson production of Once Upon a Mattress. Do you have a musical director and choreographer, or do you do all that by yourself?
No, I do not do that myself. I've got a couple of people who have done quite a few shows at the Phipps. Music director is Ruth Ashwood. And she is doing a very fine job taking the limited number of voices we have and giving it a good full choral sound and not ruining the humor. And my choreographer is Chris Adam. The best thing I can say about Chris is, in my head, I saw what I wanted a couple of these numbers to look like and the feel I wanted them to have. And Chris just nailed it. Couple of numbers people are just going to really enjoy because they're just energetic and, well, downright silly, but well done.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about you a little bit. You said you've been acting and directing for something more than 40 years.
Yeah, I'm a theater generalist, and I don't like to get pigeonholed as an actor or a director. I've actually even written several plays. A couple of them were actually produced professionally in Chicago and New York City, off Broadway in New York. I don't want to give anybody the idea that I'm walking off with an Obie or a Tony here, but it was done in New York, and we had a chance to maybe get off Broadway, but didn't quite.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I do a lot of acting as well as directing, and I think in my case, the two kind of feed on each other. I have a lot of actors that just love working with me because I'm what I think of as an actor's director. I think of myself more as a facilitator than a director, because what I try to do is meld what I see as the best that everybody has to offer and find a way to take the best and put it together in a whole program. That's a little different approach than coming into a show and having an ironclad concept you want to work with. I prefer to wait and see who and what I have to work with and go from there.
How did you start getting involved in theater in the first place?
Well, I haven't shared this with many people, but I think the real reason I went into the communication arts and theater specifically is my parents were immigrants from Czechoslovakia, and when I started school, I couldn't speak English because I was home with my mother all day.
Oh.
And I think, growing up in a small rural area, I was the weird guy till I caught up with the English, and I think that probably had a hand in making me want to get into theater and performing and express myself that way.
Now, you've been able to spend most of your working years in a relatively small area compared to a lot of theatrical types who travel all over the country to find work and so forth. How have you been able to manage that? Most of your shows that you've done are in the Twin Cities area, but then you've moved into Wisconsin and other parts of this sort of region. How have you been able to do that?
Well, I have been lucky with some of the quote-unquote regular day jobs that I've had. Was allowed some flexibility to be out on the road for a while now and then. Also, I've been real lucky with a lady named Stephanie, who is my wife, who puts up with a lot in regards to me being gone and coming home and always supporting me, even though it's difficult for her. Well, I was gone for 5 summers out to Medora, North Dakota, and I played Theodore Roosevelt for 5 years. She was home alone, and she'd come visit a couple times during the summer, but there are daughters and grandchildren, so she chose to stay closer to home most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, the play is Once Upon a Mattress. The director is John Koenig, who we've been talking to. The show will open Friday, March the 9th, and continuing Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays at the Phipps in Hudson through March the 31st. Ticket information is available by contacting the Phipps ticket office at 715-386-8409 or online at thephipps.org. John, thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Again, the Phipps phone number is 715-386-8409. And all things happening at the fabulous Phipps in Hudson can be accessed online at the Phipps, that's PHIPPS.org. Thanks, Jim Oliver. This is Spectrum West on WPR. According to a prestigious source, the best college in Wisconsin for LGBTQ students is the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. I've determined my personal designation is MHOC, male, heterosexual, older, and curious. Today, the only one that really matters is curious because to be so is my job. To help quell my curiosity, Chris Jorgensen, who directs the UWEC Gender and Sexuality Resource Center, was kind enough to pay a visit to the Spectrum studio. Well, let's talk about the Gender and Sexuality Resource Center. What is its history? Why is UW Eau Claire's exemplary, do you think? Without bragging, of course.
Oh, of course.
There has to be somebody who got the whole thing rolling.
Well, it's a relatively recent history. The LGBTQ component was added to what was then the Women's and Gender Equity Center back in 2009. I entered the scene in 2010. We did a lot of infrastructure change so that there could be a full-time person there so we could actually build upon the work we were doing from year to year. That's what we've done from 2010 to now. Now I am in the Division of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. It's been me in the office with student interns And now with a graduate assistant. So we just sought to do programs and events and advocacy that was as useful as it was entertaining to the students who needed it the most.
How has it evolved in the 8 years since it began? Did it start kind of grassroots and it's come a long way?
It did. You know, my budget, although it isn't astronomical now, was infinitesimal then. It was very small. So I really had to think about what I wanted to do creatively. Mm. And I'm really thankful for that, actually. Because I think it has you tap into resources you wouldn't otherwise have if you had just lots of money. So I was able to use the talents and creative outlets that were available to me, both in the community in the Chippewa Valley and on campus. You know, when I was interviewing for the job, I just told them, well, you know, I'm coming from Los Angeles, so whatever I'm going to do is going to be very public and very unapologetic. And they were like, yep, that's fine with us. Cool. I was like, okay.
All right. So we know that you came from Los Angeles. What other credentials did Chris Jorgensen have that made you appealing for the position?
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, Waupaca, Wisconsin. Went to UW-Eau Claire in 1994 until late 1999. So I was a student there. I came out when I was 19 on campus. It was very different then. And usually when you say then, you think decades, but really in 15 years, so much has changed in the United States, and that has been reflected on campus as well. So I had an intimate knowledge of what it's like to be LGBTQ at UW-Eau Claire.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really worked from there. I tried to create programming and establish resources that I wished would have been there when I was a student.
Yeah. How about growing up in Waupaca? Not a big town.
I've always been one of those personalities that is able to be friends with lots of different kinds of people.
Sure.
And my family, to their credit, never treated me differently. Even though I came out when I was 19, you know, I'm sure people have their inklings, especially your family, you know, when I was gay. But they never, ever treated me differently. I mean, my mom and sister were wonderfully supportive. My dad, who's very much small-town Midwestern hunter-gatherer,
okay.
You know,
yeah.
Has never, ever treated me any differently. So I'm very lucky
great.
In that
yeah.
regard, because a lot of LGBTQ people don't have that.
No. In order to succeed, of course, the place, the center has to be a collaboration, and at UW-Eau Claire, everyone's involved, faculty, staff, administrators, and students. I'm going to assume that recognition, like you have received, Best College in Wisconsin for LGBTQ students, bestcolleges.com, Campus Pride, it's a sign of a healthy environment in general, conducive to real education. Not just from books and within lecture halls.
Yeah, I was really pleased with that particular ranking. You know, when you get a ranking like that, the first thing I do is kind of like, okay, who's it coming from? You know, to see if it's an established entity. And Campus Pride is the entity in the United States that institutions used to gauge their inclusivity for LGBTQ students on campus. So that they were the biggest part of it. And then the Trans Clearinghouse in Massachusetts, Sue Rankin, who's incredibly well known as a scholar, lent some gravity to that particular ranking. And, you know, UW-Eau Claire in the last 8 years has done a lot. We have put policy and procedure in place that allows LGBTQ students to see themselves institutionally. So whether that's preferred name policy or our large selection of all gender restrooms on campus, or gender inclusive housing, to programs like the Fireball, which just happened this past weekend, or the O'Queer Film Festival. What I liked about this particular ranking is it was pretty holistic. It was both infrastructure and policy, but it was also what sort of events and programs are offered that don't just recognize the difficulties one has as being LGBTQ in the United States or the world, but also celebrates right who we are. Because I think that's equally as important. That along with even our academic side of having an LGBTQ certificate on offer, which is not common in the United States, lent themselves to that particular ranking.
How much of an uphill battle has it been, though, to get to where the Resource Center and the recognition for which UW-Eau Claire is deserving to get to that point? Did there have to be some pushing and shoving along the way, or was there? It doesn't appear to me as if something like this would have been an easy row to hoe all the time.
I will say, to start off this answer, that I have been extraordinarily lucky to receive a great deal of support from the uppermost administration on campus, great. Including the chancellor himself. Without that support, then there's no way we could have received that ranking, because I'm far outranked by many people on campus. But that they actually believe wholeheartedly in the mission of the office and where I would love to see UW Eau Claire continue to go. Makes all the difference. And really, when you're looking, even within the UW system, what it looks like on different campuses varies drastically.
Is
that,
it really?
Yes, very much so. So, you know, where I'm a full-time employee who is the director of the Gender and Sexuality Resource Center, in some campuses, someone who's in my role will actually be full-time elsewhere or three-quarter time elsewhere and just have this tacked on. As a quarter position.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that reflects the commitment, right? I mean, you know, money in higher education in the United States, but certainly in Wisconsin, has been a very contentious issue as of late. But if institutions have as their core mission equity, diversity, inclusion, then you have to put money where that mission is.
True.
Because if you don't, then it's reflected in the student experience on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And at UW Eau Claire, we have really done a lot of work. And though, of course, there's been some push and pull, largely I have been given a great deal of latitude to be able to do what I want to do on campus.
That's the voice of Chris Jorgensen, director of the Gender and Sexuality Resource Center at the University of Wisconsin. Eau Claire, the best college in Wisconsin for LGBTQ students, so says bestcolleges.com. I've read your words of pride,
absolutely.
But you say it's also a reminder of work yet to be done. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that work.
Absolutely. I think there are two ways I think you can regard a ranking like, you know, number one in the state of Wisconsin. One, I think you can say, look, we've arrived and now we can just enjoy success. That's absolutely not the route that I always take. I always kind of express, okay, I'm really excited for that. I think it recognizes the work that we've done. But in order to truly earn that ranking, we need to continue to do very important work. It doesn't necessarily mean that each and every LGBTQ student has a positive experience on campus.
Yeah.
The work that we have to do is, you know, to engage in anti-racist work, to make sure that our queer people of color on campus mm-hmm. are having positive experiences, to engage in trans positive work, to have sorts of conversations that educate people on the transgender community so that they can also have really inclusive experiences on campus. You know, that work is difficult. You know, discomfort is a regular byproduct of that particular work and that growth. I see my job as, you know, recognizing that we've done great work.
Yeah.
To say, okay, so now what can we do to build upon that, to use that as a foundation? I don't view it as a period. I view it as a semicolon.
You brought up the fireball, you know, and I understand and appreciate the seriousness of this discussion and the collaboration, but there is a lighter side, a playful mm-hmm. side, if you allow yourself to see it. Is that a fair analysis of the thing that you also need? You don't have to always be analyzed.
No. Activism doesn't always have to be laborious and
awful either.
Right. You can be having, you know, one hell of a time, but also be engaged in really important work,
yeah.
right? Just by people showing up to the fireball says this work is important. Sure, it's a great time. 3 hours of just glitter and Lord knows what else.
Is it a melting pot of people?
The people at the fireball are all over the place. We have people in their 80s, been to tons of drag shows, people who are 7 or 8 who've never been to any drag shows.
Mm.
It's all over the place. But every theme of the fireball deals with very serious issues, right?
Sure.
I mean, this year's theme was revolution. And so given the political climate that we're experiencing in the United States and certainly around the world, it's important for people who would otherwise be quiet or say to others, well, I just don't get into politics,
mm-hmm.
to say, yeah. well, that's a privilege that you have to say I don't get into politics. But as an LGBTQ person, I'm thrust into politics whether I want to be or not. My very identity is politicized.
Okay.
So we need people to engage in that political process. And that's part of it. But I tell students all the time, a deficit approach isn't always the approach that I want, which is to say, spending all of our time talking about all of the difficulties we have at LGBTQ people. We have to spend as much time celebrating who we are. And I think that allows for a healthy balance.
Mm-hmm. I read a Chicago Tribune article about the fact that the initialism keeps growing. LGBT,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and then Q is added, and now it's IA at the end, uh-huh. which is intersex and asexual yeah. or allied. Some people mm-hmm. say that the initials just continue to stress people's differences. Others say it's unifying.
I think, you know, it's important to note that there is no mothership acronym. Truly, people feel very passionate about the acronym they choose to use,
uh-huh.
But there is no correct one. And I understand why people want their identities represented in the acronym, but it becomes really difficult. Nobody can even say it, let alone tell you what the letters stand for.
Sure.
It also is complicated because the identities that are represented in each of those letters are vastly different. Just by having them in that particular acronym, people think that there are natural correlations with them. So, sure. For instance, if you're talking about sexual orientation, well, that's very different from gender identity. Very different. But people conflate the two.
I maybe should come to some of your meetings.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I need to learn some more stuff about
it. Yeah, we've got lots of presentations that just unpack the acronym. And people do find it illuminating, I think, just to hear about things as complex but as ever-present as sex and gender and sexual orientation, et cetera.
What's important is for people to self-identify and for us to believe people when they do identify. Mm-hmm. Cool. Hey, congratulations on the recognition.
Thank you very, very much.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, where an average of 97% of graduates go on to employment, further schooling, or volunteer service within 8 months. Information at luther.edu. Got on stage coming up with Jim Oliver, and I have a couple of Spectrum memos for you. Right now, a while back, I received news about an annual experience called Reading Across Campus at UW Stout. Coupled with Stout standing as a polytechnic university, I thought, let's get literature and Stout's artistic side a little more lime in the limelight. This year's focal point is the movie and book Fences. So I contacted Peter Olson, an English and philosophy lecturer, and he had everything I wanted to know.
I started this about 4 years ago, but I think there were three or four reading events, which came under various titles. When I got here, the first reading event, or Reading Across Campus as it was called, was the book 2001. And the way that was established, we decided that our readings, our books, were going to also have films associated with them. So we could gather in a large theater-like room and watch the film and discuss the film either before, during, or after the film, but or in classrooms. Let's see, we had 2001, and then we had Fahrenheit 451, which is a provocative book, Ray Bradbury, and then we had the book by E.L. Doctorow, Ragtime, which has an excellent film associated with it. And this year it is August Wilson's Fences.
Is this part of a class or classes? Is it extracurricular? What is it?
Well, it's both. Typically what we do is we work with the library. We order a large number of books that can be used by students in classes. So this year we had about 250 copies of Fences, and they were all assigned to students, and it sounds to me like about 10 or 11 classes were using the book and reading the book, and teachers were involved. We have a professional development week in January, and we got together and we talked about strategies for teaching Fences. But we came together with issues of curriculum and so on. And then students read the book in various fashions and interpret the book according to the way the teachers want to get into the material. Then we show the film. Then following the film, this Thursday at 4 in the Harvey Hall Theater, Lou Bellamy from Penumbra Theater is going to be here. And he founded the theater, I think, in 1976. Uh-huh. And he has a 12-year association with August Wilson, the author of Fences.
That event on Thursday is free and open to the public.
Indeed, yeah. We hope people come. And this is a great opportunity. I would almost say, from what I can tell, this is really a high point in the history of Reading Across Campus as a program. Lou Bellamy is a person of really important stature in theater and in African-American theater and the development of the theater and so on.
In describing some of the things you've been kind enough to answer, you've used the word we a lot. You're talking about the university's literature committee. Tell me about that group, because you guys are the host of this each year.
Yes, and thanks for noticing that collective sense of our interest in discussing and presenting literary events. The literature committee started about 1986 or so, and it came together with several faculty. I'm not sure any of the original members are still with us, but some are with us in the sense that they are still living and in retirement, but some have passed on. They began this committee as a way to engage discussions of literature, to talk about curriculum, talk about interpretive problems for books, various kinds of books, fiction, nonfiction, literary criticism, things like that, and pedagogy, the problems of teaching literature. I say problems, but the concerns that we have to teach more literature, but also how and what sorts of theoretical ways we interpret it, and how to get students interested in reading books that are of value to students' careers and students' intellectual lives and so on. And, of course, part of the Literature Committee's purpose is this outreach that we do, reading across campus. We also have programs, the Reading Series, where we bring various authors and people involved in literature into the campus to speak with students and faculty, mm-hmm. presentations, giving Q&A, current creative writers. Sometimes we have poets, literary critics. We've also had in our reading series occasions where we bring students in, and we have sort of thematic or author-based reading days. We had a day last year, I think it was, where students read poems from T.S. Eliot's The Book of Practical Cats, Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. They enjoyed that, and some dressed in cat costumes. Then we had a program this past November where students read poems by Langston Hughes. And we also had some faculty. Mm-hmm. Virginia Lee and her husband, Babatunde Lee, talked about Langston Hughes and his relationship to jazz and also to the civil rights movement.
On the phone with Peter Olson, lecturer, English and philosophy in the College of Arts, Communication, Humanities and Social Services at UW-Stout. The conversation starter is Reading Across Campus, which is going on now. And, of course, Peter alluded to, and I'll remind you about an event on Thursday being dubbed the main event. We'll have the details for you in just a moment. This year's spotlight, Peter, is of course, as you said, on the play, movie, and book Fences. Is social significance part of the criteria for what is selected each year? Because Fences is fictional with more than a dash of nonfiction relative to our nation's history.
Yes. Yeah, that's good to notice. I think we have an agenda on campus. Of course, many of the students involved are interested and partake in intercultural competence and the development of multicultural awareness and such. And students have about 40 hours of general elective credits, and that's essentially where the greater amount of the liberal arts are given and are experienced. So Reading Across Campus speaks to that initiative. And of course, literature has never been shy of these things. So historically, much literature has always engaged society and challenged society to do and think differently. And I think, going back a couple of years, Fahrenheit 451, the value of the written word, the book, imaginative literature, preservation of literature, the story there, of course, is the destruction of the book. Coming out of the 50s, the worry about totalitarianism and what that might do to the ability to think freely and liberally.
I always like to get to know people I'm speaking with personally and get an idea of their biography. And although we don't have time to get into that very deeply, it appears from what I've read about you as if your academic career has two chapters, one in music and the next in literature.
That's right. And I went to the University of Minnesota as a music theory major. I had an opportunity there to receive a master's degree in music theory. And then I moved later to the city of Memphis, University of Memphis, the old Memphis State, and then pursued a doctorate in literary and cultural studies after spending some time, actually, in their music department in ethnomusicology. Then I lived in Muscle Shoals, Alabama for a dozen years. For those who aren't aware of that word or that name, small city, it is a storied and famed music town, produced over 10,000 records, I think, startling amount of product, music production over the course of a decade or more. Exciting place to be, really centered around four musicians, couple studios. That's probably not fair to say only four musicians, but there are four important musicians working day and night in Muscle Shoals to make all those records.
I've met a lot of musicians who feel as if they cannot or will not get the authentic sound they're looking for unless they either do a pilgrimage to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, or go down and actually play and record there. It is quite a mecca.
Yeah, there were two, maybe three decades where it was just a rich place to work. The names are too many to list, but people like Paul Simon and Bob Seger and the Staple Singers and so on really made their most important records there. Maybe it's the musicians themselves. I think it is. I always thought of it as a conversational style, a way of economizing their playing. Of course, they didn't read music. Obviously, what musicians love about Muscle Shoals is the feel, rhythmic feel.
Yeah, well, let's save a future conversation for music only, shall we?
Okay, I'd love to talk more about it.
Yes, as would I. And I told you in a previous conversation that you're only the second ethnomusicologist I've ever met. Reading across campus, we have details on an event coming up Thursday. For now, I'll let you go. Peter Olson, thanks so much for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you, Al.
And the Reading Across Campus main event, if you're listening to the Thursday rendition, you haven't missed it. It's 4 p.m. today at UW Stout's Harvey Hall Theater. Lou Bellamy, founding director of Penumbra Theater in St. Paul, is the guest speaker. Spectrum West. Hey, Jim, I see you're still in the building. We're curious what's on stage in West Wisconsin. What do you know?
The University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Theater will present Kingdom Come through Saturday and next Tuesday through Saturday in the Riverside Theater at the University. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Junie B. Jones Is Not a Crook Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the Oxford Theater. Driving Miss Daisy will be staged by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild March 8th through the 11th and the 15th through the 18th at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls will present Peter Pan March 9th through the 11th and the 15th through the 18th in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater. Pinkalicious the Musical will be staged March 8th and 9th by the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. Don't Hug Me, We're Family will run Fridays and Saturdays, March the 9th through May 19th at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. And the Backwards Thinkers Society will stage a UWEC improv show Saturday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Here's another Thursday-only reminder. Arts West 39 is now featured at the L.E. Phillips Library in Eau Claire. There's a reception. If you're listening today, Thursday, it's tonight, 7 o'clock. Awards are going to be presented at that time. I appreciate the helping Hannah. Mr. Colin, back me up. And first-rate Kate. They do some nice work behind the scenes for us. Next week, Choral Masters prepare to wrap up another season, An Old Friend in Need, and more. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. We'll do it again next week. It's called Spectrum West. Appreciate you being here. See you then.